You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I don't know any scholars who would go to the mat to claim that today's story is an historical episode in Jesus' life. It's like other miracle stories, a parable about the parable teller, meant to make a point. Plus, there are strong hints this story has been influenced by the familiar story of Jonah from Hebrew Scripture. Or perhaps it was crafted as a counter story to the fame of Apollonius of Tyana, a contemporary of Jesus of Nazareth, and one of the primary competitors with Jesus in the marketplace of religious ideas. Apollonius was regarded as the master of storms, of fire, and of perils of all kinds. So who knows? If things would have gone just a little bit differently there for a while, we might all be Apollinarians rather than Christians. So the author of Mark wanted to make sure that Jesus was on the same par with not only Apollonius, but with Zeus and Poseidon. And since water was the symbol of chaos in Hebrew culture, all the better. Jesus had been teaching the crowds for hours. He was exhausted. The text says he taught as long as they were able to hear him. Enough is enough. Instruction time was through, and he was drained. Rather abruptly, Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "We're out of here." So he and the disciples got into the boat and got away from it all.
Our words of wisdom are from Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through 41 in the Voice Version. The same evening, Jesus suggested they cross over to the other side of the lake. With Jesus already in the boat, they left the crowd behind and set sail along with a few other boats that followed. As they sailed, a storm formed. The winds whipped up huge waves that broke over the bow, filling the boat with so much water that even the experienced sailors among them were sure they were going to sink. Jesus was back in the stern of the boat, sound asleep on a cushion, when the disciples shook him awake.
"Jesus, Master, don't you care that we're going to die?"
He got up, shouted words into the wind, and commanded the waves.
"That's enough. Be still."
And immediately the wind died down to nothing. The waves stopped.
"How can you be so afraid? After all you've seen, where is your faith?"
The disciples were still afraid, slowly coming to grips with what they had seen.
"Who is this Jesus? How can it be that he has the power over even the wind and the waves?"
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Do you know what the most popular, best-selling book of all time is? You might be surprised. According to itself, it's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Why? According to the author of the book by the same name, it's not because it's actually that helpful. In fact, it's riddled with inaccuracies. The first reason is that it's cheap. The second reason is that on its cover, in large friendly letters, appear the words, "Don't panic." That alone is such reassuring advice that people in Doug Adams' universe carry the book with them just for the reminder. And it's a funny thing, that phrase, "don't panic." You know where else it appears most often? The Bible. It's usually in the form of the phrase, do not fear or be not afraid, but it's there over 100 times. All through Hebrew scripture, fear not, I am with you. At Jesus' birth, the angels have to tell the shepherds, fear not. Jesus said it over and over and over again, don't be afraid. It makes me wonder how different people's attitude towards the Bible might be if instead of a very intimidating Holy Bible on the front cover, it said in large, friendly letters, don't panic. Why? Because fear is a powerful thing in our lives. It prompts us to seek protection in times of very real danger. It motivates us into needed changes and surprising adventures. It's the constant motivating force of advertising companies, always reminding you that your breath is bad and that little ache that you have is the onset of a terminal disease, unless you tell your doctor about their pill. It drives us to do things we would otherwise never tolerate without being whipped into a frenzy of fear. Preemptive military strikes, secret rendition and torture, internment camps for our Japanese neighbors during World War II, and threats of mass deportations starting tomorrow. How easily we are manipulated by fear and take actions we would otherwise never even consider. It's a constant reminder of how fragile, limited, and very human we are. On the other side of these impulses, we know fear also prompts us to resist an openness to mystery and wonder of the unknown and isolate ourselves in hiding. It keeps us from even doing what we are perfectly capable of doing. And this morning's story is about that kind of fear. When Mark tells the story of the stilling of the storm, it's very likely his small community was either facing or recovering from persecution in every direction. And in the face of whatever they were dealing with, their fear was projected on God because they felt God's absence. I think we miss the point if we reduce the story to a fantastic tale of Jesus wonder-working. If we do, many people end up wondering, where's that power to avert destructive hurricanes and tornadoes today? Such claims also get religious leaders in trouble all the time. You might recall the frequency with which the late televangelist Pat Robertson would pray to divert hurricanes from his Virginia-based office in Regent University. His properties may have been spared, but the folks who lost their homes because of his claimed influence weren't so impressed. Now, some folks have no philosophical difficulty in taking the story literally, which is okay, but don't get stuck there. Along with the rest of the Gospels, I think it has even more power and deeper meaning when it's seen as a parable, one with meaning for our everyday lives. People know what it's like to be in the midst of storms. People know what it's like to have no control. People know situations where the sense is that only the divine can intervene. People cry out, Lord, save us! Tomorrow, the United States will re-inaugurate a president. For some, this is a moment of hope. For others, it's a threat akin to opening Pandora's box. And from every side, the political rhetoric feeds on fear, fear, and more fear, dividing communities and magnifying distrust. And it's scary knowing that the conflict in our country is not going to be resolved by the waving of some magic wand. It's going to take work, grit, sweat, patience, strength of will, and therapy. We know that everything doesn't always work out the way we hope. So in the final analysis, the question is, what do we do when what we feared could happen has happened? What do we do with what we've got in front of us? Have you seen that office sign? If you can keep your head when everyone else is losing theirs, then you don't fully grasp the situation. Did Jesus not fully grasp the situation in this story? No, I think he was perfectly aware of the situation. He'd spent all day teaching and was beat. He was going to get some rest. He was on a boat, lulled to sleep. What could go wrong? After all, he was on a fishing boat with whom? Experienced fishermen. What's to worry about? Well, let's rewind a bit. In the whole chapter leading up to this episode, Jesus has been doing one thing, teaching on how to respond to Jesus' teachings. You've got yourself the parable of the sower, the secret seed parable, and the mustard seed. Jesus clearly points out that only those who are ready to hear and to see will understand. And surprise, the lunkhead disciples don't get it. They're typically self-congratulatory. Yeah, we're with Jesus. Thank you. Yeah, we've got the all-access pass. We got it covered. Right before they prove once again that they don't get it. According to Rex Hunt, the disciples had developed an unhealthy dependency on Jesus. Now, normally, you might think that dependency on Jesus was a good thing, but no. Walter Wink is another who alludes to an unhealthy dependency on Jesus. The disciples woke Jesus with reproaches. They also lacked faith in themselves. Jesus, you deal with the storm, they said. Jesus could have said, give me a break. You're the sailors. But like an impatient parent, Jesus is exasperated and just takes care of it himself. I mean, you know the drill, right? I mean, you can get your kid to do it, but sometimes it's just easier to do it yourself and get back to your nap. The disciples had the resources and failed to use them. This isn't a story for us to just sit back and say, whoa, isn't that Jesus something? It's a story challenging the hearers to not be terrified of life, to use our God-given gifts, confront your fears, forget your dependency, claim your resources, do what you do. Then there's that other gospel, the gospel of Thomas, which didn't make it into the canon and wasn't very widespread, but may have just the summary of what this parable is all about. If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. The real miracle is not in something spectacular happening, so we can all sit back and say, wow, Mark seems to be telling us a story where even Jesus is saying, the real miracle would be if you guys actually took some responsibility and did something that is perfectly within your power to do. My New Testament professor, Paul Sampley, was forever reminding us that the Greek word for faith, pistis, is better understood as a verb, not a noun. Faith is not something you have. It's something you do, that you express in action. You can't gather it, save it, possess it, or hoard it for when you need it. It's not like collecting stuff. You demonstrate it with your life. The founder of our Methodist movement, John Wesley, had his own storm at sea crisis. He was a priest in the Church of England who was struggling with a sense of relevance. More than anything, he wanted to get God's attention and approval. So in an effort to do something radical, in the hopes that God would say, "Hey, nice job, pal," he signed up to be a missionary to the British penal colony in Savannah, Georgia. And let me tell you, in the 1730s, Savannah, Georgia was not much. Mainly prisoners, pirates, and a few bedraggled Native Americans. On the way over, they sailed into the biggest storm of the season, so bad that even the crew were making preparations in case the mast broke. Wesley went down into the hold with some of the other passengers, where he found some other missionaries on the boat, Moravians from Germany. To his surprise, here was this earnest group of lay people singing hymns and reading psalms by candlelight, appearing to be perfectly calm. And it drove Wesley crazy, because these people seemed to have their act together. And here he was, a professional Christian, panicked that he was going to die. The whole episode haunted him with self-doubt throughout his failure of a stay in Georgia. And by the time he made it back to London, he was just a wreck of a man, because he'd been confronted by the actions of these people who, in the midst of a storm, were centered and at peace. He was a wreck. These Moravians did what they knew best, singing and praying, while Wesley was wishing sedatives had been invented by then. Their behavior left a huge impression on Wesley, and it helps us to remember an important distinction. The opposite of faith is not doubt. It's fear. "Why are you afraid?" Jesus asks. Fear paralyzes people into inaction. Faith is action. So what could be better for a stream of thought than reminding ourselves, don't panic? Acting out of one's faith, being a faith-er, means understanding the situation, knowing the odds, knowing what's ahead, being realistic yet remaining calm, even in the midst of a storm. You might be familiar with Rembrandt's interpretation of today's story called The Storm on the Sea of Galilee. You also might remember that back in 1990, it was part of the largest art theft in American history, having been brazenly stolen with 12 other pieces of art from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Still unresolved, by the way. But rest assured, whoever has it on their wall can clearly see the disciples in a panic as their boat is being lifted by a huge wave. Two of the disciples are rushing back to the stern of the boat where Jesus is asleep. Now, all the details seem to be right, except for one thing, something strange about the painting. How many people should be in the boat? Well, 12 disciples of Jesus make 13. But if you count them, there are 14. What? Examine it closely and you'll notice that one of the men in the boat is Rembrandt. He painted himself into the picture. And therein lies the real challenge of this parable. Can you paint yourself into the picture? Can you draw on the deepest part of yourself to take action and not give up. Because if you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. But if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will make you whole. So put yourself in the picture. Keep speaking the truth. Cultivate genuine community. Practice compassion. Act with courage. In short, be not afraid. Keep putting love first. And whatever you do, don't panic.
Hey, and don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Thanks, Ryan.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.